Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for the week of June 5th, and with me early on a Sunday morning is Jim Allen. How's it going, buddy?
It's fine here. It's a beautiful Sunday morning in the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast Annex Studios in beautiful downtown Koenji.
Yeah, man. Yeah, gotta love it.
Do indeed. So our luxurious settings, and we're ready to rock and roll.
We are, and we are going to rock a little bit. We've got an interview this week with Brent Morel of the Oryx Buffaloes. He's the guest, and we're going to talk about Oryx, Norimoto's record, Interleague, and more. So let's get started.
Clearing the bases!
All right, so I went to Tokyo Dome yesterday. This is a fresh interview, really, hot off the microphone.
Wow.
And this is on Saturday. I went and I sat down with the very friendly Brent Morel. He's from Bakersfield, California. This is his second year with Oryx. And, you know, he played, he was drafted by the White Sox in 2008. He joined the Buffs last year and played alongside Brian Bogusevic, who was on the show with us last year, and I met Brent, and I said, hey, we want to have you on as well, and then I never saw him again. He played 94 games, but every time I went to the game when Oryx came to town, he wasn't around. And, you know, Bogusevic only got into 60, and it seems like I saw him a lot more. It was weird.
Yeah, well, he was, he did play a lot more at the beginning of the season, and then... you know what? You want to say some things like nothing works will do will surprise you other than doing the right thing. But I was surprised that Morel got a job back again this year.
Yeah.
Because he didn't really play a lot and they didn't seem to know what to do with him. And then, of course, he started the season on the farm team. I don't know what was up with that.
But this year?
Yeah.
Yeah, I asked him about it. He had a broken finger.
Oh, okay. Well,
and
that
he showed me the finger.
It.
Yeah, he showed me the finger.
He gave you the finger. Wow.
He's not Mr. Met.
Hashtag high heat.
Okay, meet the Mets. Okay, well, yeah, somebody wanted to be a bad ball hitter at that park. So, he just came back up recently, and which, you know, the contract and then not being with the team was the mystery, I guess.
I guess
after they kept him, and then. Especially after Stefan Romero went down, and now they're both back. They're both healthy, so interesting.
Yeah, I was surprised too that he hit .244 last year. He didn't really do all that much, and I was surprised to see him back, but glad, because I think you get a foreign player who's got some continuity, and I think it's good for the team, and I expected him to do a little bit better, or, you know, expected to see a little bit more of him, and of course, he's... Like you said, Stefan Romero went down with the injury, and they brought Brent up recently, and he did have a key hit in a game in which they won last week, so that was good. He's still spraying the ball, playing sparingly this year, and he's a very even-keeled guy. You'll get that impression from him when you hear the interview. We sat down in front of the Oryx bench just after the team stretch and sprints. And very, very friendly guy. Here's what he had to say.
All right, we are thrilled to be joined by Brent Morel of the Oryx Buffaloes. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we saw you last year and wanted to talk to you, but didn't get the opportunity. So we've got the opportunity today. So I'm going to get right into it. I've been a critic of this organization for a long time. And I look at roster construction. I look at the GMs and try to figure out what they're doing. I look at the decisions on the field and all that stuff. But it seems like they got cleaned up in the offseason. How's this organization this year compared to the way it was last year?
Yeah, obviously this is the only organization I've played for in Japan, so this is kind of all I know. But I have a really good relationship with the front office and coaching staffs and the higher-ups here. I mean, they treat us, just as foreign players, they treat us really well and, you know, give us an opportunity to come in and compete and set us up. So, I mean, it just seems like a different feel this year compared to last year. Obviously, winning a little bit more games helps, but... it just seems like everyone's in a better, like, mental state around the field.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, only second year, but the atmosphere from last year seems a little bit different. And we talked to some of the Japanese players, and they said it's a little bit smoother. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we've taken on an identity just as a team, like from a player standpoint. I mean, I think Teokata does a great job of being that vocal and physical leader. You know, I mean, he's obviously putting up the best numbers that we have, and he's also, you know, we have individual meetings and we hold each other accountable, and that was something we lacked last year.
Now, you said your relationship is good with the front office. What do you mean? Are you able to, like, we talked to Matt Clark in the offseason. Mm-hmm. He said he was able to call up the GM and have a sit-down with him. Are you at those terms with the GMs?
Yeah, I mean, they're around. Like, if you ever need anything, you know, it's an open-door policy. I mean, if there's ever anything on your mind that you want to speak about or ask questions about, you know, they're always around and give us that opportunity, yeah.
Now, how much does that front office stuff that's going on there impact what actually happens on the field with the players?
I don't think really much of it matters. I mean, I've grew up in baseball, you know, I mean, even 10 years, I think, professionally now. And, I mean, you see so many things that don't make sense to you as a player. And you're like, well, I wouldn't do it this way. But you got to, like, take yourself out of that equation and just make it simpler on you, and don't think about what you would do or this and that, and just whatever they ask of you, you know, you go out and try to do your best and, you know, let them make those decisions.
All right, what about the field manager? Fukuda obviously was something new for him early on. How has he improved?
Good. I mean, you know, like, it's always tough, like, with the language barrier for us, you know, for them, but just seeing him interact with the Japanese players, and it seems like they all respect him, and, you know, he kind of demands that respect, and that's all you could really ask for. I mean, but I don't really have, like, too much of a relationship, you know, with many of the coaches here.
Right, I understand that. Now, what does he excel at? You know, what does he do well from, like, preparation to in-game management?
Yeah, what's fun about here, actually, just thinking about that, is watching him work yesterday, just because it's the no DH and interleague play, you know, so you got to kind of do some different things. So it's like getting your pinch hitters ready and your bullpen and everything. So it's just fun to watch. I played a couple years in the National League and been around that. So it's first time in Japan being able to witness it and just see the different strategies and philosophies. But really, as a manager, I just think you got to keep the guys confident, keep them relaxed, and I think he does a good job with that.
What's important for fans to know about managers in the areas that they don't see? Like, you talked about getting guys ready to pinch hit, but we can't see that because guys are doing that behind the bench. What's important for fans to know about a manager in the areas that they can't actually visibly see, like game stuff?
I know, like when I was in Pittsburgh and I wasn't starting every day, as a bench player or a role player, you like to know your role and, like, be prepared for it, you know? Like same with the bullpen. You want to know, like, if you're the eighth inning guy or the seventh inning guy or you're the long guy, you know? And just if you can establish that role and help you prepare for that, I think it only helps when the time of the game comes.
All right, now, I believed, and they're opening up the gates here, so it's going to get noisy. I believed this team had a lot of talent to finish in the playoffs last year, and it didn't happen. You guys had a good start to this year. What can we expect from this team? I mean, you guys have had a little bit of up and down to start the season, but what can we expect going forward?
Yeah, it definitely was a good start, and then we went through a rough patch of, I think, 9 in a row, losing. You know, we're on a nice little hot streak right now, but I mean, we definitely have the talent. Like any team, you know, I think it starts with your pitching staff. You know, you got to pitch well to go deep in the season and deep in the playoffs. And our pitchers have been doing a really good job lately. And, you know, we're just trying to score enough runs, you know, to help them out. But definitely has the talent. And, you know, I don't see anything to hold this team from going pretty far.
Why the inconsistency sometimes?
I think that's just baseball. Like, obviously, you're going to have ups and downs in baseball, and the sign of a good team or a good player is to limit those bad times. You know, it's like you're going to have the losing streaks or the offers, but, you know, it was tough for us to get out of that losing streak. It took 9 games, so if it happens again, you know, just want to do a better job of getting out of that streak a little bit sooner.
Right now, you guys are just coming off of a losing streak, and you catch a team on a losing streak. What's the mindset when you go up against a team that's in a skid?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a good place mentally as a team when you keep, you know, 8 or 9 games. So you don't think about it too much, but at the same time, you just know, like, late in the game, if there's a situation where we can come back, you know that they're thinking like, oh, here we go again, or, you know, they don't have that confidence. So as an opposing team, you know, you got to really capitalize in those moments.
All right, now, your impression of the Eagles, because some of our guys, we do a preseason prediction show, and we pull out some of the bloggers and some of the guys, and they all seem to think that the Eagles were going to do well, but no one had them doing this well. What's your impression of them so far?
I mean, they're a great team. They're really tough to play. They have everything, really, you know, the starting pitching, the bullpen, and the offense for them is just putting up crazy numbers right now. So, I mean, if they keep us up, they're going to be a tough team to beat for sure.
Obviously, Takahiro Norimoto has got this strikeout record going. He faced you guys during the streak here. Is he that good?
Yeah, I mean, I think he really is. Like, I don't remember him, because I faced him last year, and I don't remember him being as good. And when we faced him again a couple weeks ago, I mean, he really impressed me and, you know, all the guys for that matter. But
what's he doing differently?
I don't know if it's anything different, but he just has a lot of confidence right now, and he's got really good stuff. You know, he pitches with his fastball, which not too many guys in Japan do. You know, he challenges you, so you have to respect that, and he's got a really good slider. So, I mean,
he's throwing a changeup the other night, too.
Yeah, I mean, he's got great stuff.
Take that, Giants.
Yeah, and he's got the confidence to go with it right now, so it's a tough matchup.
All right, you guys, next week or this week are going to face the other team in the Kansai area in the Kansai Derby. How important is that? Does the team let you know that that's a really important matchup for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, it probably means a ton to, like, these guys, the Japanese players, just growing up in the area, you know, and it has so much more meaning to them. It was so fun for me to play in those Cubs-White Sox games when I was with Chicago, so... I mean, I know what it's like to have that inner city rivalry, and just going to be fun to be a part of it.
Okay. Last question. Now, you played a bunch of different positions. Which one's your best, and which one do you feel more comfortable at?
I would just say third base, just because I've played it pretty much, you know, my whole professional career. I just am confident over there. But they mainly just play me at first and third, to play a little second, a little outfield in the past, but... I mean, I enjoy playing third base the most.
All right. Well, good luck, and good luck the rest of the way. Appreciate it. Another California guy. Yeah. Always like talking to you guys.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks again, Brent. We appreciate the time.
Yeah, it was good talking to you. So I look forward to seeing you guys again.
All right. So what stood out for you and tickled your ears this time?
Well, a couple of things. One, I thought fantastic insight into the, you know, it's almost like we had like a spy in the Oryx organization there. And I don't mean to say that in a bad way, but I mean somebody actually giving us information, because, you know, we see Oryx kind of like the Kremlin.
Uh-huh.
You know?
How is that?
Well, in the sense that nothing that looks normal, you know, everything that we have difficult, we look at it and we just try to guess what it means. Because it's just shrouded in mystery, and, you know, things happen that seem to defy belief. And I guess with the palace coups and, you know, the coup d'etats, pretty much the history of the Oryx organization. I don't mean that in a violent way, but I'm just saying that it's so often more about office politics than it is about baseball.
Right, right.
Or it has been.
It has been.
So I think the thing that few things struck out, which is one is Takahiro Okada being a vocal and physical leader. I can imagine him being that type, but I wasn't, you know, until you actually hear somebody say it.
Exactly. Yeah, I was shocked. Yeah, for him to say.
Because you see that in the games. He's running his mouth with his teammates, but I hadn't seen it in practice. I don't remember seeing it in practice because he used to be kind of the quiet guy.
Well, because he wasn't, let's say, a candidate for team captain, because he wasn't producing a lot of times. A lot of times he was so much involved with himself and trying to get his game together and trying to stay on the first team and be productive, that he didn't have time to look around and say, hey, you need to do this, son. You're a rookie. Give me
Well, the other thing I've had people tell me, and I wish I could quote the people who told me this actually, is that you get a lot of guys basically shoot their mouth as soon as they start doing well. And when the rest of the team's not doing well, they shoot their mouth to basically blame everybody else for the team's mistakes. And that's the kind of leadership that's fairly common in baseball.
Right, right.
I don't know how that applies to him, but that may or may not account, that may or may not apply. But the thing that's interesting, I thought even more so, was we hold each other accountable, which is something we lacked last year. Now that, I believe, that was to me the most interesting thing, because it's almost like Oryx was the team that baseball knowledge forgot. You know, doing the things you need to do to win were sort of like, I guess, and you know, that fits my conspiracy theory about the Oryx front office, that if the front office doesn't care if you win or not, it's really hard for the players to invest in winning, you know, to take that extra step when, you know, nobody else cares. So
exactly. Yeah. And I was there. I was right there with you thinking, okay, accountability, which guys didn't necessarily do last year. And you see it a lot of times, a guy comes off the field and he has made an error, or he has done something, make a mistake. And you see his teammates try to pick him up in front of the cameras and say, okay, you know, don't worry about it. Shake it off. We'll get him in the next inning or whatever. But what do they say in the locker room?
Yeah. I mean, actually my, although I don't see this nearly as much as I used to, but almost every baseball broadcast in Japan had, whenever a guy made an error or made a mistake that the announcers pointed out, when he walked off the field, they almost always tried to capture a frame of him and the head coach, and the head coach opening his notebook and writing something down. Right. And I'm not kidding you. And that was Haruki Ihara, who, when he was the Cebu Lions head coach, he pretty much started that. And everybody, you know, that was the thing head coaches did. You know, I got your name. You're on report, son.
Right. We've got documentation of this.
Exactly. I mean, it was all about taking notes and, you know, and fixing mistakes. And the head coach is going to get you now. And so that used to be the thing. It's not really the thing now. You don't see those shots. I'm not saying the head coaches don't pay attention, but I'm saying that it's no longer sort of the institutional requirement for TV broadcasts to show the head coach doing his job. So anyway, how this ties together is that's sort of the players. That's to some degree, you know, that's the manager's job, but that's the player's job. And essentially that's the team job, is to keep each other, you know, to make sure, to be certain everybody knows they're doing their job and, you know, they're working together. And I think a lot of people said, well, we play as one. And essentially that means that we don't have to check up on each other.
Right.
But you do need that accountability. I mean, that's essential.
Right. And I thought that was a great line. And I started to think back about it last year and thinking, okay, well, they lost a lot of games. And did we see anybody say, hey, man, this is not acceptable. You have to do this. And, you know, Japanese players don't normally, even though we talked about Takashi Yamasaki, the former Dragons, and those guys who would berate young players and that seniority and that hierarchy within the team. But we don't see a lot of berating on the field.
No.
And we sometimes see guys yelling at each other in the major leagues and some spats on the bench and this and that. But they usually do it in the locker room. And I would like to see more, you know, just guys just being, you know, if a guy makes an error, if he does something wrong, if he's not in the right place, see some more emotion. I've seen some of the foreign pitchers do it. I saw Miles Michaelis, I think, was earlier this season at Jingu Stadium, and he's holding his hands up thinking, what are we doing here? What are we doing, guys? And I want to see.
Well, I think part of that, I think that was I saw that same scene and I thought two things about that. One, he's going, well, why did you make that bad relay throw? Because it was a play where, there was a couple of plays, but one was, why did you make that throw? And the other one was probably, why did I throw that pitch?
Yeah. Now, something that Brent said that I agree with, talking about the instance where he tried to take himself out of the equation when he has a situation with the front office or the management or the style, the field management or the style of play or something like that. And he's learned over the years that, look, you're just a player, go out and try to execute. And this is something I think we spoke about last week, mm-hmm. that the players can't be so concerned about the how and just go out there and do the what. You know, this is what we have to do. Let's do our best to make it happen. And you hear a player say that, look, you know, this isn't how I would do it, or I'm not sure that this is the right thing. He says, look, just remove yourself from the equation. I like the way he phrased that. I thought that was really good.
Yeah, telling me, I thought, wow, this guy's eloquent.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say eloquent because I don't get to say it often enough.
I also thought it was interesting for him to say that he doesn't have much of a relationship with the manager and the coaches. And I think kind of he's oversimplifying the situation. I don't think he's saying, hey, look, I never talked to him. I never asked them questions. They don't talk to me. Mm. I think it was more like, hey, you know, we don't make jokes in between innings. We don't go out for beers. You know, it's not something that you might have seen in Mr. Baseball or anything like that, but
what you mean taking baths with the manager's daughter? No, probably not.
Hashtag high heat.
No, let's hope not. But let's hope not. But no, I think he was oversimplifying in that respect. But I thought it was interesting because I remember a lot of times Jose Fernandez when he was playing with the Lions and mm-hmm. when he was playing with the Eagles, and I asked him. I was on the field with him one time, and the manager came out and. Hoshino was the manager and of the Eagles, and I asked him how many times a week he actually spoke with him. And he said, "Oh, not that much," because he said hello as if he hadn't seen him in a while. And I'm thinking, how often do you talk to him? He said, "Not that."
Well,
much.
I think that's Hoshino. He's just he's happy to see the foreign players all the time, and happy to see foreigners in general. He likes foreigners. He likes that thing, talking to people from other countries, and so he gets animated talking to us.
Okay, that explains something, and we'll get to it later with Masahiro Araki's 2000th hit. Mm-hmm. He Hoshino came out onto the field, looked like he wanted to give Araki a hug.
I'll bet he did.
And Araki wasn't having any part of it. But we'll get to that situation with him later. So one other thing that
the Hoshino situation, I love it.
One other thing that I liked in Brent's, well, two other things. One was he said, know your role. And mm-hmm. knowing your role and having that. And I always stress that. Longtime listeners of the show know that I stress that probably more than I should. And a lot more than Jim thinks it's important.
No, I
want it to be important, and you don't.
No, what I'm saying is it doesn't. Roles don't have to be.
Don't have to have butter.
Yeah, definitely not.
Don't butter them up. Just say, you just do what I tell you. Don't think. Just do what I tell you.
I'm not saying. I'm just saying that roles don't have to necessarily be this role or that role, but they being defined helps and being flexible helps. But again, that's all part of the planning. But I'm just saying this, you know, I'm going to say this. I had a recent chat with Hiroshi Gondo, the former Bay Stars manager, and we talked about what he did with his bullpen. And I'll make this really quick, but basically he didn't have a sixth inning guy, seventh inning guy, and eighth inning guy. He had about five middle relievers.
Mm-hmm. I remember this.
He trusted in every situation. And what he would do was say, you know, first guy out of the chute, everybody, you're the first guy out of the chute today, you're next. And everybody would know they're the next guy to go. Right. So and he got ripped mercilessly for this because it was different. And it wasn't a sixth, seventh, eighth inning guy. It was, you're the next guy. He called it his middle relief rotation. But it worked beautifully. But that's what I mean. I mean, it doesn't have to be the roles, but I agree with you in the sense that having a role and having something that's defined and something understandable is huge.
Okay.
And that's what Brent's saying, and that's where I think we agree.
Well, I think he was saying the communication was really the key to the whole thing, just knowing what the manager expects from you.
Yeah.
And I think that was the key. All right, and the other thing I wanted to touch on was him talking about, I asked him about catching a team like the Giants that's in a tailspin.
Mm.
And it just seemed like, you know, he didn't want to think about it. You don't want to think about the opponents. I mean, each game is its own event.
its well, that's own what individual I, that's event. That's what I was expecting when you asked the question. And when I listened to the answer, I was thinking, wow, he's talking about Oryx.
Well, that too. That too, because they had lost 9 games in a row recently, yeah. And they were just trying to get out of that funk. But yeah, I was expecting something like, you know, you don't want to catch a team that's losing that many games in a row, because you figure they're going to, the law of averages said they're going to beat you. So that's what I think, but I understand the mindset that you don't want to think about the other team. And he's like, whatever, if they're having trouble, maybe in those key situations, they start to think about their losing streak.
Let's not pick on those bad teams that have, well, the thing that got me was, we're a good team, and the good teams minimize those losing streaks, and and we had a 9-game losing streak. I'm still sort of going on, and I'm saying, it's not like you had 9 bad games; you had a bad month.
Right? Yeah, they did have a bad month.
They went 6-19 in May, and they didn't win 2 games in a row until May 20. They won the last 3 of those games.
Right, at the end of the month, and we were joking about how they could lose the most games in a month in club history, right, and all that stuff, and they won their last 3 games of the month to start this winning streak that they're on, right, which is good. But, you're right. He did sound like exactly like he said, in those key situations, you start to think, oh, we don't want this to happen again. And when you
sounds
said
like,
it, you, they were talking
like
about orgs.
Yeah, he was speaking from experience, which most of these guys can do. So I don't think it's saying, we're bad, but this is what happens with bad teams. And you see that not only in games, but you see that in seasons. It used to be, I was looking for historic patterns when teams did well and teams did badly. And from like 2004 to 2009, the Bay Stars winning record was much worse in September.
In September.
It was September and August. It was much worse than it was the rest of the year. You basically had a 400 team that was playing, a 380 team that was playing 280 baseball in August and September because they were out of the pennant race, and they were, every time they were losing, they went, oh, well, here goes another one. that's my interpretation of that.
Okay. Well, let's continue talking about the Buffaloes. Now they have won 6 consecutive games, and they haven't lost yet in interleague play. And it's just like Brent said in the interview, the pitching has been doing good work, at least the starting pitching for sure. And Chihiro Kaneko leads the way. Brandon Dixon is having another strong season so far. Yuki Nishi's up and down with an ERA. With an ERA just shy of 4, but essentially 4. And Daiki Tome Ningen, my buddy, he's finally back. He pitched really well and got the win the other day. And then Takahiro Matsuba, who's also wobbly at times, but he pitched well on Saturday and beat the Giants. So that was, they're doing okay. I know Phil Koch had to leave an injury last week with a start, but he's doing okay. In the bullpen, Yuta Kuroki. And he's got this name, Kuroki. Well, I just want to call him Johnny, just for no reason.
Wow. Well, I hear you.
So Kuroki's a rookie, and he's been good for them. And Yoshihisa Hirano, the closer, has done enough wobbling and wriggling to get through 12 save situations, including one last week in which the final out came against the Lotte Marines, and Shunta Goto from center field had to gun down the runner on a 2-out base hit in the final inning. So there was some debate on that play on Twitter, and I said, you got to send the runner. There's 2 outs, and you've got a hit. The odds of you getting another hit are low. Maybe not so low with Hirano on the mound, but anyway, they're low. And you got a better than 50-50 chance to get the guy home, and it was a 2-out situation. I'm sending the runner every time. But anyway.
Which explains why John is doing the podcast and not somebody's third base coach.
Right. Whatever. If they hire me, I'd take the job. Let's put it that way. I can swing my arm.
Wow.
Hey, I'd be like Dave Okubo and just send a runner every time. Make a play.
Right.
Hey, yeah. I've seen bad throws and drops, and you got video review now. Maybe somebody has a toenail on that foul line. Call can get overturned. You never know.
Oh. You never know.
All right, so obviously they had this 9-game stretch and they had this bad May, but they, you know, they did play the Hawks during that losing streak. They played the Hawks, they played the Japan Series, or reigning Japan Series champion Fighters, and then they played the first place Eagles before going to Chiba. So it's understandable that they would maybe lose more than they would win in those, in that stretch.
Well,
but 9 is a lot, and to lose every game was tough. Yeah. But so I asked him about the team, and you know, they're just weird. This is just a strange team, and I don't know how to evaluate what we've seen the first month, almost 2 months now. It's really hard. How do you see them? Well, no, I mean, we've seen them start out really strong, and we see them struggle significantly, and now they're winning again, in part because they're facing a team that's struggling itself. But I mean, how do you see, this team as a contender?
Yeah.
Maybe for that playoff, that last playoff spot, or do you see this team as just...
Well, they've got the talent to do it, but they're sort of impulsive about winning and losing. Like, we haven't won in a while. We better win. We haven't lost in a while. It doesn't kill us. I don't have any explanation for works about these streaks. I think they're trying to find themselves. Maybe I don't have confidence that Fukuda can solve us, make some small adjustments to the things that another manager might be able to in terms of his pitching. On the other hand, you know, I don't see a lot of patience there. And like every time Oryx, unless it's Nishi or Kaneko, I really can't guess who's going to be the next Oryx starting pitcher or Dixon.
Or it's hard to figure out what the lineup is going to be. It's hard to figure out who's playing.
I don't have a problem too much with the lineup, because pretty much everybody he throws out there is producing. But the pitching has been, you know... has been a mystery to me. Now, if it's a mystery because there's a plan and I can't see it, that's fine. But if it's a mystery because it's a mystery to more than me, then that is a problem. You know, if it's a mystery to the team, that's a problem. So I don't have a good guess on whether, you know, it's you had this the same analogy with the Dragons early in the season. You know, is there a plan here? I don't see it. But if this is the plan, to look disorganized, I don't like it.
Right. Yeah. Well, the Dragons. That's a whole different animal. But I think you look at Eiichi Koyano, who is a veteran, and he is obviously he's batting 326, 325. 325 mm-hmm. as we head into games today, so he's carrying that team. And I did talk to Hiroyuki Nakajima before the game.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did. And I said, you know, how do you see your role? Because you don't start a lot, you don't do this, that, and the other. He said, you know what? I'm not focused on anything except trying to help. We have a lot of young players, and I'm not focused on anything except trying to get these young players, show them how to take really quality at bats every time.
Oh, that's interesting. That's pretty analytical for him.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I didn't expect that. I was expecting...
No, I don't either. Oh, I'm just here doing my job. I love Nakaji, but, you know, he is what he is. It's a force of nature.
And the other guy, I did talk to Stefan Romero briefly before he had to do his toss batting. And I asked him who he thought was the best... Japanese position player on the team, because they've got these young talented players, and I was shocked. And this goes back to us talking earlier in the show about the interview with Brent. He said Takahiro Okada.
Well,
I was floored. I was floored.
Well, let's see. We've got a guy whose basic position is the batter's box, and let's see who's the best hitter on Oryx. Okada. Okay.
Best home run hitter, best RBI guy.
Well, I think he's the most productive hitter on the team right now. I mean, but they've got a lot of the other thing, and he's the guy who's playing every day.
And so, yeah, and to find out that he's a vocal team leader, from Brent, it's just shocking. So, this team is just weird. It is weird.
It is weird, but at least they're weird winning.
Weird winning. All right, let's make a seamless transition and talk about Interleague a little bit. And, geez, big surprise, the Pacific League, as we head into games today, is leading 21-9 already.
Well, you know, I wouldn't read too much into that 21-9.
Why not?
I sincerely doubt they're going to finish the Interleague with the Pacific League winning 70% of their games. But
why not? Who's going to stop them?
Well, yeah, I know.
For that to happen, the Dragons and the Swallows and the Bay Stars and the Giants, for that matter, are going to have to stand up and,
well,
and start knocking
first
people
of all,
around.
The Giants and Swallows happen. Won't go 0-18. So
no, yes,
no, they won't.
No.
So they won't. So
they might win a game, is what you're saying.
Yeah, they might win. They probably win three or four games, just as you said, the law of average.
Stumble into it. Yeah. Oh, now you believe that now? Okay, good.
I didn't believe it in regards.
You're speaking
to
from my behalf.
I would never try to put words in your mouth. That's
because you might get bitten.
Hashtag high heat.
That's pretty much the main reason, indeed. But what I'm saying is, probability doesn't work like that. If you got a 300 team, and you know they've lost six or seven games in a row, they're still basically have a 30% chance of beating an average team. It's not like things go in their favor just because they've lost six in a row. However, that being said, if you look at the future, if you look at 18 games, what are the chances that a 300 team's going to go 0-18? That's a different equation. So I think the Swallows and Giants will not get, you know, wiped out 18-0 in interleague play.
Okay. But, all right. Well, this is on tape, so we got this. I really liked the first night. It left me with a lot of impressions. I like what Hanshin did. I like what the Eagles did. I like what Haruhito Hamaguchi of the Bay Stars did at Sapporo Dome against the Fighters. But for me, the image, the indelible image of the first night of interleague was Ayumu Ishikawa of the Marines sitting on the bench with his head buried in a towel after giving up six hits, four walks, and seven runs in four and a third innings in a 15-7 loss. That is going to stay with me. It being the first game or the first night of interleague, I think I'm going to remember that until the last night of interleague.
Well, the one I remember, and I posted this on Twitter, was the second night of the Giants against the Eagles. Giants manager Yoshinobu Takahashi just sort of staring blankly onto the field, like, what are we going to do to get these guys out? You know, with these guys.
You think
not...
he was thinking that? I think he was thinking, man, you know, I was sleeping. They woke me up in the morning and called me into the office and said, you're no longer a player, you're a manager. I didn't want this. That's what I think he was thinking.
Okay. Well, I was thinking, you know, you're not in Kansas. You know, this is the sort of like a couple of things. You know, I 2 days before Interleague started, I happened to be at Tokyo Dome, and I heard CARP manager Koichi Ogata giving his pre-Interleague little thing for the CARP beat writers. And he said, like, you know, I asked him, how do you prepare? Because you can't deal with interleague play three games a year the same way you prepare against the other five teams that you see 25 times a year. And he said, well, they're not going to know about us either. That's like, if we don't see them, they can't see us.
Right. They're not looking. Nobody's looking.
That's right. So let's
doing
all
any
not
research
look.
Here.
You know, that's the, I, I've heard
peekaboo,
that.
Man.
Yeah. So I think he was just trying to get over the question as opposed to saying, and he said, we know the scouts are giving us reports, and I'm sure they are, but to assume that everybody is as prepared or unprepared as you are is probably inaccurate. Because I know some teams, although with 18 games, it used to be 36. With 18 games, the importance of being prepared for interleague is less so. But on the other hand, interleague is a chance where you can, you know, you could conceivably pick up, 18 games on the rest of your league.
Right. There can be some serious separation going on here.
Right. Because, yeah, because all the other five, no, you could be the only team winning in your league. And So there's still that option. But his point was, well, we prepare, but we're not going to be too worried about it, I guess is what he was trying to say.
Right. The other thing I thought about the first night was Tomoyuki Sugano of the Giants getting banged around for 8 runs and 10 hits and 5 innings for him. And I just thought, man, you know, it's like, aren't they going to take him out? Don't they see that he's not very effective tonight? And is it required in his contract that he pitch 5 innings regardless of how bad he's doing?
He wasn't pitching badly either. That's the thing.
You know, I talk with scouts about these things sometimes. I think because they say the same thing. There's a guy making bad pitches and getting knocked around as opposed to a guy making good pitches and still getting knocked around or giving up runs. And I said, yeah, well, what's that have to do with the team? You know, if you're losing and you want to still try to compete in this game, let's see if somebody else can get it together. But, you know, quite honestly, the way the Giants have been playing, they don't really have a lot of options. So I suppose they figured he was still their best option to get through some
innings. I think that. I thought the pitches were good, but he was getting frustrated with the swings. I mean, the top of the Eagles order was driving him nuts, just like, going, okay, challenge him with that fastball, and you think you're really good because we're gonna foul it off. We're gonna keep fouling off your good pitches.
Right.
And Egor Omogi and Carlos Puguero. Carlos Puguero looked like he was batting like a leadoff guy up there. He was just like going, let's run, and they ran his pitch count up to really crazy stuff in the first. He'd thrown like 50 pitches over the first 2 innings.
Yeah, it was a mess. It was a mess,
and so I saw that having watched those two games. So I thought that was more of my impression was the Eagles looking like, yeah, you know, we eat you guys for breakfast. There was a story one of the people posted on Twitter about the MLB. I think it was the Dodgers scouts came specifically to watch Yoshitomo Tsutsugo play in Interleague because the Central League only has one good starting pitcher
of
major league caliber.
Yeah, right. That's
Sugano. So against specifically, we'll get to see him face better pitching and see how it, you know, see what we can learn from that. And it's harsh to say they only have one MLB caliber pitcher, but to some extent, with Chris Johnson out, that's true.
Yeah, right. Well, like I said, I expect to see some separation in the Central League with this. If the Carp are the top Central League team at the moment, and hopefully, as you and I predicted last week, they can hang on. Let's shift gears and make a four-seam transition and talk about Takahiro Norimoto of the Eagles. And on Thursday night at Kobo Park, Miyagi, he fanned a dozen Giants in a 3-2 victory in Interleague, and that gave him 7 consecutive games with double digits in strikeouts, and he broke the tie he had set the previous week with Hideo Nomo's 1991 record. So he has the new record. And before the streak, I have some notes about the streak that are cool. I did some homework.
You did. You have cool stuff.
I got cool stuff. So the streak began on April 19th versus the Lions. During the streak, he has faced the Lions once, the Buffaloes twice, and the Marines twice, and then the Fighters and the Giants. And the Marines have the second most strikeouts in MPB behind the Carp. So to get them twice, I think, was kind of fortunate for him. But
and the Lions strike out a lot as a rule. So,
as a rule, but they are not the league leaders, obviously. And you know, he we talked about it last week. I pointed out specifically that he's been getting a lot of guys to swing and miss at his secondary stuff, and he was throwing a changeup too that night.
I know.
It was just mean. It was just unfair.
That's what I was thinking too. I'm going, where'd this come from? They were against the Giants. It was like. He was throwing. They were hitting his fastball. He was basically establishing his fastball, and they're going to go up. He's going to throw us his fastball, and we're gonna get good swings at it. And they did, and they weren't barreling it up, but they were making contact on his fastball. And then when the changeup came, it's like nobody told us about this,
right? All right, so Norimoto during the streak, he has 76 strikeouts. and 12 walks. Isn't that a great ratio? He has thrown 832 pitches, and he is the strikeout leader in MPB since he started this streak. And his next game would be, if they stay on schedule, it would be Thursday against the Bay Stars at home. So back
another
at
team that strikes out a lot.
They are I think second.
Typically, the Bay Stars almost for the last 7 or 8 years have been the number two or either the strikeout leaders or second most in the Central League.
Yeah, the Bay Stars are in the middle of the pack in strikeouts in the Central League. So, and then Norimoto had one shutout during the streak, and that was May 10th against the Lotte Marines. And he started the season by fanning 8 Hawks in a 7-1 win on April 4th. And he fanned only 4 Lions on April 12th, which is kind of a shock, right? You think the streak should have started that week. So, he has been great. He said in his press conference after the game, he said, "I couldn't have gotten this record without my teammates." And I know it's a line, and I thought at the beginning, I thought, well, you know, you're striking guys out. Who's helping you? You know, but I understand the concept.
Well, yeah, because if there weren't any other pitchers, he'd have to pitch every day.
Hashtag high
heat. I hear you. You know, I'm with him on that. It is a team game, and you're because you're limited to a fairly specific role. You know, you depend on your teammates doing their job. Otherwise, you know, you'd have to do more and more and more, and you wouldn't be able to do it as well. So I certainly, you know, that's what it means to be a closer.
Yeah,
you're good because you're expending all your energy in a very narrowly defined space because your teammates allow you to do that. The plan allows you to do that. So none of this would happen without your teammates. And perhaps more in the past, but I hear you. I mean, we used to have pitcher, you know, we get some players in Japan who say, "I didn't do anything." And I was always waiting for the time for Tsuyoshi Shimoyanagi of the Tigers to strike out 27 batters and hit a home run in a 1-0 game and say, "I didn't do anything."
Because that's what he would say.
That's what he would say.
And the one thing he also pointed out about that night was he said the skipper Masataka Nashida. Told him, gave him basically carte blanche and said, you know, you can pitch as long as you want if you want to go for the record. And so he went in, he went to the mound knowing he could throw as much as he wanted to, basically, and as long as he was able without hurting the team. But the thing that was really interesting is it was a close game.
Right.
And then Yuki Matsui came in the 9th inning and got a break and got out of he let the first runner on, and then he was behind in the count, and it looked like he was going to be in some trouble. But he got out of the inning and got the save, and they won the game. So it was a great night in those terms.
Well, you know, he did say that, you know, the record was I was very conscious of the record and of needing one more strikeout going into the 8th inning. But on the other hand, the game was more important, and I have to agree. And I know you tweeted, you know, are they going to blow the game apart so you can get the record? And I was thinking, if I'm a pitcher and I'm tied with a record with Hideo Nomo and we lose the game, or if I'm tied with Hideo Nomo and we win the game, or if I break Nomo's record and it costs us the game, where does that leave me? So I think being tied with Hideo Nomo is pretty darn cool. Yeah, I thought too. What he said, I think he had it right. Nobody wants to be the guy who loses the game to go for a record unless your name is Kanemura.
Oh, shebang. All right, so, and yeah, he did. He struck out the side in the 8th, and he went through the heart of the order. Sakamoto, he got Hayato Sakamoto, Casey McGee, and was it Shinosuke Abe?
Mm-hmm.
No. All right, so sticking with records and a player who's achieving something, Masahiro Araki of the Dragons on Saturday also got his 2,000th career hit. And, you know, I looked at him this season and him going for 2,000 hits, and I badmouthed him early on saying, the only reason they're playing him at second is so they can help him get to that record. But he marched to it very quickly, very...
Yeah, that's a Dragons thing.
That's a Dragons thing.
Did you notice that? I mean, Tanishige, he did that too. when he got 2000, and Wada blew past 2000 like nobody told him the record was coming.
Yeah, they didn't get nervous. They didn't sputter. They didn't get to the precipice and then get nervous and sweaty and all that stuff.
Wada needed two hits. He got them in his first two at-bats. He got another hit that day. He kept going the day after that. And it's like nobody told him.
Right. So he's 39. He became the 48th player to reach 2,000 hits. But he has the fewest home runs of any of the 2,000 hit guys with just 33. I remember, I'll tell this story again. I've told it, so again, another reference to longtime listeners. But when he was a up-and-coming player, I would go to the Dome and talk to players like, this is Nagoya Dome, Alonzo Powell, and I talked to Leo Gomez before games. And, you know, basically, they're just the I guess about the 5 o'clock, I would say the 5 o'clock pregame.
If they're the home team? They take infield.
Right.
About 5 o'clock. Yeah.
The 5 o'clock pregame stretch, and I was sitting talking to Leo Gomez, and my foot hit Araki's foot, and he said excuse me, and I said excuse me, and he said excuse me, and I said no, excuse me, and it was that Japanese thing where, you know, we wanted to both take responsibility for hitting each other's feet. And he was a nothing rookie or young player at that time. Just, he was a defensive replacement, come in, maybe steal a base, perhaps a pinch runner late in games. And I never thought of him as a hitter. And I don't really think the team, he was a top draft pick. He was their first pick when he was drafted in
1995.
Yep, 1995. And, he said at the presser, after he got the 2,000 hit, if he hadn't even come close to 2,000 hits, he would still have been proud of his career. He's a guy who 6 times in a row won the Gold Glove at second base, basically pushed Mr. Dragon Tatsunami off of second base into a corner infield spot because he was getting older. And, well, you don't think so?
No, I had a different thought on it, but I'm good with that, I think.
Okay.
I think it's okay.
Okay. And he was a great defensive player. And I think, they played him in outfield sometimes. He started out trying to switch hit. And I mean, he's come a really long way. He's kind of similar like Takahiro Arai of the Carp when he got his 2,000th hit. He just kind of, he's been a guy who has stuck around, but he was a really quality player. I heard Tatsunori Hara was doing the color commentary on one of the games this past weekend, one of the Giants games, and he said, he talked about Araki, and he said, with they called it the Araiba combination with mixing their two last names, Ibata and Hirokazu Ibata and Masahiro Araki, mixing their last names. And Hara said, well, it didn't matter which one of those guys was batting first and which was batting second. It was one of those nasty combinations. You just didn't want to start out the game with either one of those guys. And the hit he got, Araki got his 2,000th hit on, was so classic in that he was going to right field. But even in the press conference, he said, he tried to stop his swing midway through because he didn't like, he just tried to change his mind and he couldn't. And he made solid contact and pokes the ball in the right field. It was so classic.
Yeah, well, he's one of the friendlier guys. I shouldn't say friendlier, but he's one of the very friendly guys in NPB, and he always says hi. And I don't know why that is. Unlike a lot of guys, I didn't know much about him from his minor league career. We didn't talk really much until he was a regular. But he's always very friendly. A couple of things that stood out. You mentioned him playing in the outfield. He was basically, and it's funny because in Japanese baseball, what you do in the first team is the only thing that ever matters.
Right.
And I say this because there's a story had been going around how he started his pro career as an outfielder. And that's so untrue.
Yeah, he was both.
Well, he was essentially an infielder for the first 3 years in the minors. And then they said, well, there's no way you're going to play second base, so we'd better see if you can play the outfield.
Right.
And so then when he came up to the first team, it was as often as not he was in left field or center field.
replacing Alonzo Powell.
Okay.
A lot of times, yeah.
And, right. And so he, so the story became that he started as an outfielder, but that's, you know, people don't see the other two thirds of the iceberg. You know, they see the part on the top, you know, that's on TV. Oh, he's in the, he's an outfielder. So basically he wasn't. But, and he said a couple of things. Hoshino said, you know, I didn't think much of him as a player, but he had something. And what he had was energy. Mm. And he was basically a guy who built his career on fielding and defense, you know, on fielding and base running. You know, he was a yep. base stealing leadoff guy, but he also had, you know, he was basically an average hitter who could steal bases. Didn't draw a lot of walks, but he played good defense. Now, I'll just finish this with something I tweeted yesterday, is that I went through the guys with 2,000 hits, and they're 48 now. Rocky's number 48. And right. those 48, 17 of those have played within the last 10 years.
Mm.
And you've got basically 80 years of Japanese professional baseball. And, you know, roughly a third of the guys who get to the iconic 2000 hit mark are just recent vintage. So we were thinking, you know, about some of the causes. I think the obvious one is that they play 143, 144 games now instead of 130. And that's a big thing. And the other thing is that Japanese baseball used to be really pitchers, dominated by pitching.
Right.
And while there were some really good hitters, most of the talent, the difference, the gap in talent in Japanese baseball from the best to the worst was really much more severe than now. You had so many more players who couldn't hit. You had so many more pitchers who couldn't pitch.
Well,
and so you had a few guys who ran up these absolutely gaudy numbers. When you look at the 2000 hit leaders, most of the people at the very top
mm-hmm.
are really old guys from the 50s and 60s, the stars who were, you know, beating up on the guys who shouldn't have been playing.
They also plays.
Right, exactly. So in a pitcher's era, they were putting up gaudy numbers, and so I think that's what happened.
Yeah, I'll tell you this about Araki. He's only played 145 games once in his career.
That's a surprise, because he was pretty...
He's been out there a lot, but he hasn't played full seasons all the time. So, I understand you. I think he's partially a compiler in this is 22nd season. You know, he's been relatively healthy, hasn't had the big knee injuries and everything that Ibata had. So, that's been different for him. But I did see a note on Twitter as well that he's of all the guys with 2,000 hits, only he's the ninth who also has at least 300 stolen bases.
Mm.
So, I'm looking at his defense and what he has done there, and I'm thinking, yeah, he's certainly a Hall of Fame candidate for
He's getting there. He's in the borderline. Normally when you get, you know, I think, I don't know, you and Jason were talking about Norichika Aoki, and I think no, because basically outfielders who, you know, hit 100 home runs
uh-huh.
and have 2,000 hits, no.
Yeah, I just said I think he's going to get voted in. I didn't think he was worthy. But
with Araki, you have a guy who's a gold glover. But the other thing is that the Hall of Fame has been very, very unkind to middle infielders, because basically they look at the batting.
right. Well, I think he's gonna, with the 6 Gold Gloves consecutive, he's been a best 9 guy 3 times. He never, you know, he's not a great hitter. He 269 career hitter. He only batted 300. Finished the season with 300 or better twice. So it's not like he's tearing it up at the plate. But he's been a consistent guy. Yeah,
it helps that he played in 5 Japan series.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he gets voted in personally.
I think that is possible. I like him better than Aoki in that respect.
All right, and speaking of voting, making a seamless transition, we'll talk about the All-Star voting very quickly. I know they like to update. I get these updates. It seems almost like daily on my
daily
phone.
Now.
It's kind of ridiculous. And I still don't like the All-Star game as an event overall here in Japan, because there are 2 games. I like the uniqueness and the festive atmosphere of the one game, and, you know, having one sole celebration of baseball. but whatever. The fans are voting for
whatever.
The fans are voting for Takahiro Arai, who has fewer than 100 at bats this season, and they've got a bunch of votes for him. The other positions seem to be okay with the voting, but we still have Shohei Ohtani, who's, I don't know, made 2 or 3 appearances this year. He's leading votes, and I mean that's kind of ridiculous.
He's leading as DH, and
he
played like 2 weeks.
Yeah, and Takashi Toritani at third base, the Hanshin Tigers player, is leading over Tomohiro Abe, which is give me a break category for me. I don't get it. The fans voting, I understand it, and they're getting most. I shouldn't say most of it. They're getting a lot of it right. But some of it is kind of ridiculous. So
on the other hand, this is not the sole unique all-star game. It's kind of weird and funky. So, okay, it's going to be weird and funky.
So let the funk begin. Like, all right. And especially speaking of more funk, let's talk about the players of the month.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, okay.
Or the pitchers and hitters of the month. So
The winning starting pitcher of the month and the high average hitter of the month.
All right.
Because that seems to be the primary focus. The Central League, we're going to have a surprise because the only Central League pitcher with 3 wins in May, which is usually the break point for a starter, was a reliever, Kazuki Yabuta.
Hiroshima Carp, yes.
So since he was partly a reliever and partly a starter, we're going to disqualify him, and we're going to make Central League Pitcher of the Month is going to be Rafael Dolis, the closer for the Hanshin Tigers.
Okay, yeah. He's been seven saves,
no runs in 9 innings, but pretty solid. Another solid guy was Jay Jackson, but he allowed 2 runs, so because he has an ERA, that'll pretty much
because
disqualify.
It's not 0.
Yeah, because it's not under 1 or minuscule, he's pretty much disqualified, and saves, holds are not as sexy as saves, so I think we're going to go with Rafael Dolis. In the Pacific League, we have an interesting conundrum. We have 2 guys who went 4-0. Mm-hmm. We have a guy with a 1.95 ERA and a guy with a 2.25 ERA who threw a shutout.
Extra bonus points.
Indeed. So the guy who threw the shutout is the aforementioned Takahiro Morimoto.
Morimoto, yeah.
And the other guy who's 4-0 is now Higashihama.
Of SoftBank Hawks.
Pitched in an extra game, so I think it's going to go to Norimoto basically because of the shutout and the strikeouts. But if they picked Higashihama, I wouldn't be sorry. It's going to be one of those two.
Well, Norimoto's got a record though, so
he didn't get it. Points. Well, and yeah, indeed, he did.
Well, see,
every one of his starts. No, not really. Not
okay.
In May,
then it doesn't matter.
Not in June. His record is in June. He'll probably be the winning pitcher of the month in June because he set the record in June.
Exactly.
Okay.
No matter how many games he loses in June.
indeed. I mean, we see this sometimes. So the monthly high average hitter, and oddly enough, I think we're going to have 2 guys who aren't the league leaders in hitting. Although last month was weird because in the Central League they picked Yohei Oshima because he had a bunch of singles, which happens about once a year, and they ignored everybody else who was a better hitter. And then in the Pacific League they had a 400 hitter, which they almost never overlook, so they could name a guy who hit a bunch of home runs the monthly MVP. So it was really interesting. I think the 2 guys who are going to win this year are Dion Viciedo.
Yeah, I was thinking he would be up there. Yeah.
Chunichi. Basically, he didn't lead the league. He had the 1.103 OPS, and what he led the league in was 25 RBIs.
Mm-hmm.
But he batted 341, which is acceptable. You know, other people had more home runs, other people had higher averages, but his whole package was pretty good. I think he'll get it. In the Pacific League, we have another We have a whole bunch of dilemmas. We have a guy who hit 397. Sorry, mm-hmm. Kensuke Kondo, you didn't hit 400 when they should have given it to you.
Right.
And we have two guys who hit 333 exactly with 10 home runs each. And they each played 23 games. Brandon Laird, two third basemen, Brandon Laird and Zealous Wheeler. So really interesting here. I'm going to end up going with Brandon Laird, a little better month and five more RBIs, so they can say he led the NPB in RBIs. So okay. I'm going to say Brandon Laird. But they right. but you never know. They might say Kensuke Kondo because he's had 2 months like this.
And he's still hitting 400, and nobody. I think the last person to hit 400 this late into the season. And I saw this note that there has never been a 400 nope. hitter in NPB.
Nope.
So there's going to start to be a bit of focus on him. But so the only player that he equaled Isao Harimoto's effort of going this far into the season while still hitting 400. So I don't know if that's the record or not, but officially, but you know, Harimoto obviously is a legend in NPB, so they just wanted to compare him to that. So we'll see how he goes. He's still I would like to see him actually get the player of the month, because if this team does eventually get, I just saw that Shohei Ohtani hasn't been cleared to start base running yet, but if he gets back and they actually make a run and get into the playoffs, I think Kondo could be a MVP candidate. But you can't do that unless you win some Player of the Month awards, right?
Well, you can't be an MVP candidate unless your team wins the league, pretty much. So
that too. See, well, if he's hitting 400 and his team's in the playoffs, he might.
True enough. Yeah, true enough. If you hit 400, you'll be. I guarantee, if he hits 400, he'll be MVP if the Fighters finish last.
All right, so we got to wrap it up here. We the one last note: Shuichi Murata of the Giants hit home run number 350 on Saturday. That makes him the 29th player in MPB right. to ever do that, and so we wanted to congratulate him on that.
And my question is,
we have a question about it.
I do. You know, Araki had a post game press conference, and he became the 48th player in history to hit 2,000 hits. Murata became the 26th player. 29th player to hit 350 home runs. So obviously much rarer feat. Where was his press conference? Who cared?
His post-game press conference was in the nine-game losing streak questions that he got asked.
He got flowers. He also got flowers. So, okay.
And it was a grand slam. A very, very good moment for him. So congratulations to him.
Okay.
All right, we've gone over time. I've got to run off to work. So we have a question, but we will save it for next week. And anyone else who has a question, send it to yakyujohn@gmail.com. Hit us up on Twitter @JBWPodcast with the hashtag #HighHeat, or leave us a note on the Facebook page. Thanks a lot for listening. Look for us on iTunes, and we'll talk to you next week.
See you at the ballpark.
Enjoy your baseball.